Hello and welcome to the humansinvent.com cycling podcast. I'm Richard Moore and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Good evening, Richard.
We're delighted to be joining you again after our Tour de France podcast. This is the first of a new podcast. The format will be very similar to the Tour de France podcast. We're going to build them mainly around events. So today we're going to start off by talking about the London race that we've just witnessed. We'll have podcasts during the Tour of Spain, the Vuelta, the Tour of Britain, World Championships, and we're talking about an end-of-season review podcast in a venue with an audience at some point, maybe early October. But we're very pleased to be carrying on, and as I said, the format's going to be similar to Tour de France podcast, which means that Lionel's going to tell us where we are. Lionel, where are we?
we're sitting on the pavement just round the corner from the Cavendish Hotel, a short walk from the Mall, where the Ride London Surrey Classic finished an hour or so ago.
And we actually tried to record this in a pub initially, but it was a bit too loud. But we did manage to neck a pint pretty quickly.
We did, and I think that will come through in the podcast.
I think it could help us. It's like podcast doping, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So here we are in a square on a curb around the corner from St. James's Square in the heart of Mayfair, actually. Very exclusive. We could be in the Ritz or somewhere, but the budget didn't extend to that, so we're on a curb. So Lionel, let's kick off by talking about today's London Classic, because we both attended this inaugural event. Very unusual format, where there's always been this problem in cycling of how to marry the mass participation event with the elite event. And obviously in running, you know, the London Marathon's been going for years, that the model there is that the elite runners go off at the end of the field. That wouldn't really work in cycling. So today, the mass participation element was at the start. 16,000 riders rode 100 miles. And then the elite race was held afterwards. And I think that format worked pretty well.
It worked brilliantly. I mean, the London Marathon kind of model is one that people have been talking about as a potential for an event like this. They've been talking about that since the sort of sportive revolution, which kind of kicked off at the start of the 2000s, really, when mass participation rides became very popular. There are now dozens of events, hundreds of events, across the country, where cyclists, you know, they challenge themselves on a course of, say, 100 kilometres or 100 miles. But the kind of the holy grail has always been to try and marry a professional race with a sportive event, a bit like the London Marathon, so that people who do the mass participation ride in the morning can kind of measure themselves almost against the pro race. And I, speaking to a few people who'd done the event today, they were talking about how they'd done the 100 miles in 4 hours 40 or 5 hours 10, or they'd been hoping to do it in under 5.5 hours and they'd managed to do that. And that's the language of marathon runners, isn't it? People train to try and run a marathon in under 3.5 hours or under 4 hours. And I think it's a real breakthrough to have this event. It's not unique in the world, because there's the Cape Argus in South Africa, run out of nearby Cape Town. But this combination of mass participation and a pro race is a winner for a number of reasons. Firstly, you've got the situation where to organise a professional race and close the roads, particularly in a city like London, a huge undertaking. But if you can broaden it out so that more people are involved, it's not just closing down the roads for the benefit of 200 highly paid professionals, as would be the case for, say, the Tour de France. I think you win over a lot more people and you make the event much more inclusive. And to just stand in the Mall for a couple of hours this afternoon and see all the riders coming through, some of them will never have ridden 100 miles before.
I think that was clear. Yeah, it's a shame we're not doing the Pedaleur de Charme Awards tonight.
There were some people who...
That's very disrespectful, and I apologise.
To ride 100 miles is a serious undertaking. And if you've not been cycling for very long, or if you're not particularly fit, it's an enormous undertaking. It is a marathon-level achievement, I think. And to see the people crossing the line and to witness their moments of achievement was really quite something. And I think both of us said afterwards, felt a slight pang of regret and guilt. Almost. Guilt almost, that we hadn't we hadn't actually completed the event ourselves, and I think it's sort of on the wish list to do next year.
Definitely, I've committed to it. I know that this time next year I'll be sitting here with very sore legs, having done it. I know that. I know that now. I can feel it in my bones.
That's on record now. That is on record.
Yeah. Definitely going to do it. Definitely going to do it. Very inspirational. I mean, this idea, though, that you mentioned, that measuring yourself against the pros, yeah, that's great, but it misses the point of what road racing is. It's not about the time, is it? But this is a whole other subject that we'll go back to at some point. It's a race. But that's a different... Well, let's talk about the race.
It is. You're absolutely right, but I still think there's something about riding the majority of the same course and being able to ride the same hills a few hours earlier than the professional riders. I think there's something quite special about that.
Yeah.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore and Lionel Burney.
And it was a good race. Disappointing that some of the British stars weren't riding. You know, Mark Cavendish, they were off competing elsewhere. Cavendish won final stage of the Tour of Denmark today. Bradley Wiggins won the time trial in the Tour of Poland the day before. And that highlighted really the fact that these guys weren't there. And that was a great shame, considering the thousands and thousands of people that turned out to watch. And Chris Froome, of course, is just recovering from some crits in Holland and Belgium and France.
Where he's cleaned up financially.
He won a lot of them, didn't he? He did really well.
He did.
He obviously carried that form from the Tour over into the
crits. I think we ought to point out for listeners that perhaps aren't aware that those criteriums after the Tour de France are sort of arranged.
The winner
is sort of arranged.
Lionel. Don't even go there. But I think it's a great shame that Chris Froome wasn't riding today. I was puzzled by that, considering that Team Sky have clearly got a massive interest in promoting their team on British soil, and to have the defending Tour de France, to have the reigning Tour de France winner rather, in his first proper race since the Tour would have been a phenomenal, would have made a great event even better, I think. And I heard a rumour that Sky were very keen to sponsor this event, to take over sponsorship for the whole thing. Now, the Prudential came in instead, and so it was known as the Prudential Ride London, or Prudential London Surrey Classic. And Sky, and perhaps that played on Sky's mind in selecting their team, who knows. But Ben Swift was leading the British team, and disappointing. He was led out by Chris Sutton, who then crossed the line ahead of him. He was well out of it. The race won by Arnaud Démare, who is a very, very good prospect, isn't he? Only 21. Already won some big races.
Yeah, before we talk about Arnaud Démare, I should just point out Ben Swift has come from Poland, hasn't he?
Yes, he's come from Poland, but he did want to win.
He's flown in on Saturday night after the Tour of Poland, I'm assuming, and then to race here.
That's true, but, you know, Sky took... tried to control the race as much as they could with six riders right from the start. They had Gabriel Rash riding on the front to try and keep the break down to a certain with only six man teams, you couldn't really get the break, let the break get too far ahead. Then Matt Heyman was quite prominent towards the end, so they were working for Ben Swift, so the idea was for Swift to win it.
Yeah, it's been a funny year for Ben Swift, really, because he's very, very quick, but he hasn't really had the opportunities perhaps that he has had in previous seasons, and I was interested talking to Rod Ellingworth afterwards. Ben Swift's name wasn't immediately on the list of the Sky riders going to the Vuelta a España, and whether or not he is part of that team or not, we don't know. They haven't announced their team yet, they haven't confirmed it, but it would seem unusual to me that he's a good young, still young British rider, it's a bit like he's being sort of overtaken a little bit in the hierarchy. Luke Rowe, for example, is going to the Vuelta, and you wonder what Ben Swift's got to do. And I suppose, really, being harsh about it, what he's got to do is win races like today. I mean, if he'd won that today on home soil in the Mall, it would have been good press coverage for him. It would have been huge for his profile. And it would have jumped him up the pecking order again.
A real boon. Yeah, I think he's a very talented rider. He's had real bad luck with injury. He's one of these riders who does get injured a lot. He's very sensitive to changes in position on the bike and so on. And he does tend to have a lot of niggly little injuries. But it was a great performance by the winner, Damar, today, and also by his team, Joan Alfredo, put in a great attack with about 30 kilometres to go. He went and he was away with the Belgian rider Zico, whose second name I can't actually remember, 21-year-old Zico from Top Sport, Vlaanderen.
We were speculating whether Zico Waitens was named after Zico, the Brazilian footballer, but he was born in 1991, so a little bit after Zico, the footballer's heyday. So
still possible, though.
It is still possible.
Many more Zicos.
But Zico didn't ride in a very Zico-type fashion, unfortunately. He looked tired as soon as he got in that little two-man break.
Well, he looked like he was motor pacing behind Alfredo. Yeah. I mean, he couldn't give Alfredo a spell. And at the finish, I spoke to Joan Alfredo, who is a 26-year-old Frenchman with Francis Giroux, a very talented rider, very, very classy rider. To watch him, he was riding very, very strongly. The chase was on behind him, really, and he was holding them at about a minute for quite a while. It finally faded, but he's a very strong rider, very classy rider, and I spoke to him at the finish. It was a great performance by you and obviously your team in the end. Was that a plan?
No plan for today, but we know that it's a moving race because there are a lot of little team, not a little team, but a continental team. It was a very long day because it was 220 kilometers. We know we have to move on the climb, on the last climb. We know if there is no attack, we can win with Arnaud Demar in the sprint. We do attack and the sprint on the finish.
You were looking very strong when you got away there. Was there a moment where you thought you could hold them off?
Yeah, but it's too long after the last climb. There is 40 kilometers to go to the finish line, and if you are four or five guys, it's okay. But I want to on the box hill. I asked to David Miller if he wants to come with me because I know he's a good rider to finish on a race like that. And he said, "Oh no, not now. My legs are not okay with that." So
that's surprising because we saw him being very aggressive on Box Hill. He looked like he was up for it.
Yeah. But Box Hill, it's hard, but not enough. And after the Box Hill, you have 30 kilometers with wind back. You have to ride more than 60 kilometers to take just a few seconds. So
you were quite frustrated, I think, with your breakaway companion. He wasn't able to help you as much as you would have liked. Would it have made a difference having a stronger rider with you?
Yeah, but it was when you are doing all the day on the front, it's very hard because it's not a small race because we have more than 200 kilometers. And I asked to Dominic if you want to come with me, but it was a little bit hard.
Damar, it was a fantastic win by him, obviously, and he's a great young prospect. Yeah. How good do you think he can become? Can he challenge the likes of Cavendish, Kittel over the next couple of years?
Yes, I think he is a very great rider, and he is very, 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 I don't know the word in English, he worked a lot, to be a great rider, so this year he don't want to ride the Tour de France because he think he's too young to ride a 3 weeks race. So he go to training camp at the mountain. He walks to win a race like that, and maybe next year he can win a stage on the Tour de France or maybe also won the race, just like Hambourg or Plouay or.
We've seen he's one of several young French riders who've won under 23 world championships and so on.
Yeah.
And Thibaut Pinot, obviously, your teammate, has emerged over the next couple of years. But a lot of these young French riders have not fulfilled the potential we thought they had. Do you know the reason for that? Have you got any thoughts about why that is?
I don't know, but I think we are there a lot of a lot of young riders that they have a potential for one day race, for sprints, for stage, just like Thibaut Pinot, but they are young and they have to learn. They have to make a lot of mistakes to progress, and I think it's good for the future of cycling, and because we are a generation who don't know the problem of cycling, the problem about doping or about so it's a very good sign for future.
And what's next for you the rest of the season? What does it hold?
After that I ride Eneco-Tour, Hambourg, Plouet, my second objective of the season. And after that, maybe the World Championship. But yeah. I think it's a little bit too hard. And after that, only one day race, just like Paris-Bruxelles, Quebec, Montreal.
Good luck with those.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
Okay, that was Juan Ofredo, and you are listening to the humansinvent.com cycling podcast, no longer the Tour de France podcast. Lionel, I think you caught up with a couple of the British contingent afterwards. I did too. Good performance by the youngsters in particular today, and it was a big opportunity today for the domestic teams, obviously, to shine on this great stage. It was an unusual race, and the mix, the abilities, the range and abilities was huge. You had, on the one hand, Peter Sagan, and on the other hand, the British under 23 team and some of the domestic teams. I suspect that this race, if it is here to stay, as they say it is, it will grow in prestige and profile, and some of those teams might struggle to get in the future. It certainly deserves to grow in that way, and perhaps at some stage join World Tour, but that's probably a couple of years off. But what were your thoughts about the British riders' performances today?
Well, I thought it was telling that so many of them got into that early break. And really, realistically, what are they going to achieve in an event like this? They're unlikely, unless they've got somebody who really is a very talented, by UK standards, sprinter. They're unlikely to be able to contest the actual finish. So it's about getting into the break, showing themselves off the front of the race, participating in the race. And as we saw with the GB team with Simon Yates and Sam Harrison particularly, they were very active in the final stages. But I spoke to John Herity, who's hugely experienced manager of the Rafa Condor JLT team, and he's kind of witnessed cycling in this country at the very peaks that we're experiencing now. He was a racer when there was the previous kind of glory era in the 80s with the Criterium races. City centre races were very popular, huge crowds and televised events, but then also the periods in between where we've been through a real lull, where it's been really hard to get elite level races on in this country. And I talked to him about the priorities for his team being to participate in the race at a stage where they actually could, and they got Mike coming into the early break. And it was interesting that Mike Cummings, 23, and it's interesting that he doesn't consider him to be a young rider, because in the scheme of things at the Rafa team, he probably isn't. But he said there's such an opportunity to learn and to participate in the aggression early on in the race, rather than just sit in the bunch, sit in the wheels, get to the finish and finish in that bunch, which they'd all be capable of doing. But what would they have learned from that experience of just kind of riding along in the main field without showing themselves, without getting involved in the sharp end of the race? So for the British teams, it was interesting to see who was aggressive and who was able to get into that move and actually make the race happen.
And I spoke as well to Keith Lambert, who is managing the British under 23 team. Now, this is the first year he's really been sort of full-time responsible for that under 23 team and managing their road program, and that I think has been an interesting move. Kind of a vastly experienced director. The post has been filled the last couple of years by Chris Newton, and before that Max Chiandri, both of whom I think struggled to build on the work done by Rod Ellingworth, who set up the British Cycling Academy. And I think Lambert has really got a grip of that this year, and I think we could see from their performance today that those guys are very promising. So here is John Herity and Keith Lambert.
Well, I'm in the Rafa Condor JLT team car with their team director, John Herity. And John, you've been around a long time. You've seen the ups and downs of the British racing scene. So, based on today's Ride London Surrey Classic, where do you think we are at the moment?
I think we're at the top of the world, to be quite honest. I don't think you can get anything better than this, to be quite honest. The crowds are absolutely fantastic, which is kind of a benchmark for all sort of cycle races, you know, in terms of the cyclists themselves. But I think on top of that, just how safe it was, I think that's it was unbelievable. No parked cars on the road whatsoever. Total road closures and so safe. It was just, I was going to say it's ridiculous, you know, it's unheard of, to be quite honest. And, you know, bearing in mind that I've been doing this for 25 years now, I've been all over the world now doing it. I've never been in such a safe race as we had today. But I don't think they had any concept of just how big this thing was. And I think today's, you know, the event itself has just shown just how actually big it was and what an undertaking it was for everybody concerned to put such a massive event on. Because don't forget, you had 20-odd thousand people in front of this bike race as well, you know. And they were all sort of obviously cycling friendly. And so you had those 20,000 out along the route as well. Those are the type of people that have come out to watch. So they'd have been, you know, if you hadn't had those guys riding around, the crowds would have been even bigger. But I think on the whole for cycling, I think they've got the mix right, because it's all about sort of educating people, not just to the racing side of it, but also to the leisure side of it, and getting us all a little bit more used to each other. You know, we've got to share the roads together. It will only go from strength to strength. I can't see it going backwards from this at all. It will definitely be like, you know, the London Marathon. More and more people will want to do it, and I think the places will become, you know, an even bigger premium than they were this year, unless they open it up to even more people, which I think for this first year, I believe I've already heard that it ran off so smoothly at the front, then they're already talking about being able to, you know, have more people next year. And that's great, because if the thing, you know, does grow, I think they're going to need those extra spaces for sure, because it was a fantastic success.
In terms of the race then, how important is it to your team that you're involved in an event like this? Because, again, another of the challenges is having top-level events to expose your riders to the level of racing that we saw today. I mean, there are some really, really strong riders from the continent. You only had to see the way Johan Alfredo of the Française des Jeux team led that two-man break with the Belgian fellow on his wheel. But you had Mike Cumming in the main break of the day. Yeah. Presumably that was the minimum requirement from your point of view.
Absolutely, that's what you try and do in a team like ours. He's never going to win the race, not with the type of riders that we had. So the next best thing for us to do is to try and animate the race, get involved with it in the early stages of it. We had two strategies. The first one was to try and get somebody in that breakaway that was kind of almost a textbook stuff. Now it always happens in this type of race. And then the second time was to be very vigilant up Leith Hill the first time, in case there was a springboard, you know, from that point on. So particularly we thought Sky or one of the other sprinters teams would want to try and put a rider away. And they weren't necessarily going to catch the leading group, but it would be so that their teams didn't have to work, so they could save themselves to the finish. So it didn't happen the first time up Leith Hill. It actually only happened on Box Hill, in fact, and David Miller, I think, forced it, and we had Richard Hanley in a move there. So I'm really pleased with the way that we rode, but it's an interesting point that you make, that, you know, the more and more this event becomes successful, then as organisers, they want better and better riders. If they want to, you know, guarantee having better riders, then they have to go to a HC status. If it goes to HC status, then our team like ours will not be allowed to ride in it. So that's, HC, I'm not 100% certain. I don't think we'll be allowed to ride in it, but certainly the ambition is for them to go World Tour eventually. Then we definitely wouldn't be able to ride it. If that was the case, it doesn't help. Then an event like this doesn't help a team like us, you know, specifically this event. However, I would still support it simply because it's just getting more and more people interested in cycling. So the trickle down effect for that, for us, we'd still benefit from it, but not, you know, it would be indirectly sort of thing.
In terms of how this kind of leads up to your big objective of the year, which is the Tour of Britain, it's a hard day, a single day, a long distance, so presumably ideal preparation for the stage race coming up.
Very good. It's also, you know, we've got some younger riders that were involved. It's also a little wake-up call just to, you know, just to let them know this is how tough it's going to be. You know, you're all ambitious, you all want to ride the Tour of Britain, but, you know, you've got another 7 days of this if you want to be, you know, if you want to be involved in the Tour of Britain. So, yeah, it's an excellent opportunity for them to sort of have a taster of it, and it works out well, I think, on this for us today.
In terms of observing young riders as they gain experience and seeing how they respond to rubbing shoulders with riders that they've perhaps only seen on television, what do you pick up as a manager from a day like today, observing how your riders have, what they've picked up and how they've adapted?
Well, you have to wait for feedback after the race finishes. Basically, you don't see that much during the race itself. In the case of Mike, he was there. He was in the breakaway. We sort of managed to see him, but I don't class Mike as being that young. Sort of thing. He's 23 now, so. But he's not raced with this type of feel that much. So it was good to see Mike being able to swap turns with the World Tour riders and pro continental riders like that. Still a little bit, you know, disconcerting that he blows up like he does. That's like the third or fourth time that he's done that. But at least he's getting involved in the race, and that's all you can ask of your riders, to, you know, to at least get involved. There's no point. I would much prefer to see them ride, even if it's only 50 kilometres in that front part of the bunch, and then, you know, and not in the race. So the race at least part of it, because that's very, very difficult to teach that later on. So the younger they are, I'd much prefer them to be racing in the front of the group and involved in the racing, and then, you know, if it means they blow up even after 100 kilometres. That distance will come later, but it's actually getting involved, and as you say, you know, before, rubbing shoulders with these big guys, and you're saying they're only the same as us, they've only got two legs and that. So at the end of the day, you've just got to not be scared of it. You've got to be respectful for sure, but you're just not going to be scared of them.
Psychologically, that must be very hard though for a rider. It must tell you something about the mentality of somebody, because naturally a lot of people would be defensive in wanting to just get to the end and say I finished, rather than participate in the race. But as a manager, you'd rather perhaps the other way around.
Definitely the other way around. And I mean it's human nature as well. No one likes to embarrass themselves, so their first instinct is survival, and I'm trying to like say the opposite to that to them, and we've been trying to drive that home to them all season. It doesn't work, you know. You've got you know, you don't want to bat them into the ground, so I don't keep harping on about it every single week, but every now and again we just give them a little bit of a kick and say no, this today I don't want you to race like that. You're going to ride for, we did it last week at another race whereby we just said, right, you're not finishing today, guys. I'm sorry, your job is this. You're going to race, and you're going to race for 60 mile of a 100 mile race, but you're going to race that 60 mile flat out on the front, and you're going to set up Richard Hanley or Christian for the win. And they did it. And I said, you know, I said to them, you'll get a sense of achievement out of that. You'll feel good about it, if not better, probably, than just finishing the race. And that's exactly what happened. Okay, he didn't win it, but he podiumed. We got him in the race winning move, and they were, you know, instrumental in doing that. And they were all, I looked at them at the finish, and they were a lot happier than they would have been if they'd just ridden round and finished the darn thing. So I think that's a good little success story there for us.
Excellent. John Herity, thank you.
So Keith Lambert, very active display by your boys today. Are you happy with them?
Yeah, well, I heard on the radio they've had a good go at it, yeah. Yeah, they got away and that split when the front group was away, and they got up to them. A little bit of argy-bargy, and they missed out on the when Alfredo went, but made a good effort there. Yeah, it was a shame it didn't pay off for him. But and then Sam Harrison at the end had a go.
Yeah, no, it was impressive.
You never know, you know.
I guess it's quite a big step up for them.
It is. It's a big learning experience for them. Good to be able to ride at that level and get and draw the experience from it. And they're all young boys, you know. They've spread their wings a bit today, and I've made a good go of it.
Are you taking the team to the Tour of Britain again?
Well, I'm hoping so. I don't have an official bulletin yet.
Would it be a similar?
I think we're hoping so. Yeah,
a similar squad of riders.
I think so, because we're leading into that time of the year now when it's aiming up to the world. So we've got Tour de l'Avenir in a couple of weeks, and then 2 weeks after that's the Tour of Britain, and then a week after that's the world. So it's more or less that squad now.
But this has been, I think, your first sort of full year back running the under 23 squad, hasn't it? I mean, how's that been for you, having been involved in the sport for so long, what's it been like to go back and work with these guys?
No, it's great. I really enjoy working with the young boys, and it's good to see them progress. And you see, of course, at that age as well, you see them change so much in that 2 or 3 years. They're almost changed from boys to men. You know, it's interesting to watch.
It's interesting from, I guess, your first period as a director in the sport in the 80s and 90s. You're working with guys now who've got a real chance of stepping up to the very highest level.
Yeah.
Can you see the effect that has on them in terms of, you know, they can actually see a pathway that's in front of them?
Oh yeah, and it's very important to have a focus like that, and they know what the rewards can be at the end of it. And we do all we can to allow them to progress to that, and hopefully and take the opportunity. They want all, of course. That's life, isn't it?
But, are we? I mean, obviously, it's a golden era at the moment, British cycling. Mm. Some of the guys, not least the last two winners of the Tour de France. Are the riders coming through? Are they as talented as those guys? I think.
They're certainly talented. That's why they're here. And it's how they progress from here and develop from here. It's impossible to tell at that age. Mm. You've seen so many young lads do so well as youngsters and fall by the wayside, and you see some coming through late. That's life, isn't it? But there's certainly a lot of talent in this squad now, and I can see one or two of them stepping up pretty soon.
As soon as next year, perhaps? Or?
I'm hoping so, yeah. At least one, certainly.
Josh Emerson was somebody you worked quite closely with, I think, wasn't he?
I did, but he wasn't on the... He's just on almost a friendly basis, that, because he's local to me, and I've known him since we were a kid. He's not much more than a kid now, is he? But...
Have you been impressed by his debut season?
Oh, very much, very much. And it's good to see that they're not pressing him too much to do too much too soon as well. He's had about a month off now before these two. He's obviously trying to find his legs again now, but he can't be on the crest of a wave all year long at that age. You know, you just can't expect it. You're just going to let him have a bit of time away and recover and come back again, and then the next year you push on a bit more.
Mm. I presume. I mean, you take these guys when they enter the senior ranks. So after the junior ranks, are there other riders coming through even younger that you're aware of? You know.
Oh yeah. It's the junior track worlds now this next week. And a lot will depend on how they progress very well this year. So it'll depend on how many of them come through. Maybe two or three of them come through for next year. Mm. Those three came through last year, so if there's another three comes through that this next year, that's six.
It's a bit of a conveyor belt.
Six in 2 years, isn't it? Which is a lot. But it's good to see. Mm. You know, that's what we want. We're just keeping it. It's a transitional thing, of course. It's not a permanent team. It's just a transition from coming out of the junior ranks and hoping to progress to the next stage in hopefully the career.
Yeah, as I said earlier, you've been sort of involved for a long time. I mean, the way the sport has changed, an event like this today with so many thousands of people watching, finishing on the mall, do you have to pinch yourself sometimes to realise that just how much things have changed?
No, not really, because it almost seems like it's overnight, but it's not really. You've seen it coming for a few years, haven't you? So it's great to see it, nonetheless. But, when you see people at the side of the road in the middle of a big city like this, where it's a massive operation to be able to put the thing on in the first place, isn't it? It's fantastic to see. And for these lads to experience that, big crowds like that, just like in the Olympics last year, for them to experience it, it's great.
I mean, I mentioned earlier, you know, the pathway that's there. Is one of the dangers also that riders almost get ahead of themselves, especially when they're young, and start to dream about what might be possible. Is a big challenge for you, sort of keeping their feet on the ground?
Yeah, it's a part of it. Is that I think they appreciate it's a much bigger step. And when you come up to something like today, I mean, they've ridden quite a few international races this year, but not with the field like this one. So again, it's another progression today, isn't it, for them to see? It's all part of the portfolio, as it were. But No, the heads are certainly not in the clouds. The feet, they're right on the ground. They know how hard it is from a day like today. And you just realise, it makes you realise what you have to do, and just how many guys are. You know, it's a big field there today, and a lot of them are not stars, but they're still damn good riders, aren't they? You know, so they realise what they have to do to be able to get to that level and beyond. It's a long way off. You know, it's a tall ladder, and they're on the bottom rung, to be fair. You know, they are on the ladder.
They're on the ladder.
You know, it's up to them now how they progress up the ladder, isn't it?
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
So we are here, Lionel, in Mason's Yard, in the just off the back of St. James's Square. We are the humansinvent.com cycling podcast, and we're going to talk in this little section about the transfer window, cycling's transfer window, which opened on August the 1st. And the team most active so far has been Omega Pharma, Quickstep, who've been signing riders left, right and centre. Some quite surprising, not surprising because we knew that they were coming. They've signed Mark Renshaw, obviously to be a lead-out man with Mark Cavendish. He was such a successful lead-out man for him at HCC High Road. Also, Alessandro Petacchi, who can also fulfil that role. Now, Cavendish has been after Petacchi as his lead-out man for a few years now. He suggested it a couple of years ago anyway. And I do remember hearing the rumour that he was keen for him to come to Team Sky with him, and that was out of the question, given that Petacchi has served a doping ban. And they've also signed Rigoberto Urán, who I don't think is being lined up to be Mark Cavendish's lead-out man. Urán, the Colombian climber who finished second in the Giro this year. And this is slightly confusing, because what's he been signed for? Presumably to win a Grand Tour. The deal to sign him was apparently hatched after the Giro last year, i.e. before Omega Pharma Quickstep signed Cavendish, before they even realised that he would be available to them. And I suspect they've been committed to signing him, and perhaps now it doesn't seem such a great idea.
Well, no, it doesn't look great, does it? I mean, Urán is obviously a very capable Grand Tour rider. He could finish on the podium in the Giro or the Vuelta. But Quickstep, as they were, Omega Pharma Quickstep, as they are now, they've had a torrid record with trying to have GC riders. I'm thinking back to Jose Rujano, the Venezuelan, who finished second in the Giro, I think, and certainly won the King of the Mountains competition in 2005, and then signed for Quickstep, and it was like the kiss of death. I mean, the guy barely showed himself in a race again after that, and he lasted 1 year of, I think, a three-year contract, and they came to an agreement, and he moved on. And I'm not saying that Urán, because Urán's a lot more, he's a lot less kind of, he's a lot more solid looking. He's more established. You know, he was able in the Castapan team to establish himself as a rider who could get results pretty much off his own back. He didn't require a lot of team support. And I just look at the Omega Pharma Quickstep team for next year, beefing up the support for Mark Cavendish, which clearly has been lacking a little bit. Seeing the emergence of the Polish rider, Mikhail Kwiatkowski, and wonder where Urán's going to fit in there. I mean, it's an unusual signing, but as you say, it's one that has been lined up for months and months, so there was no way that they could back out of it.
Committed to it, and I think it's going to be interesting to see where he fits in, whether they try and win the Vuelta or something. He's not going to, you wouldn't think, be in the Tour de France team, because that will give Quickstep the same problematic scenario as Team Sky had last year, when you're trying to accommodate a sprinter and a GC rider. That's not really probably the best move for them.
But you imagine that Urán would be leaving Sky because he would want to ride in the Tour, and he's going to find, I think, a similar problem. He could well be the leader for the Giro or the Vuelta or both. But I can't see, when Mark Cavendish is lining up to try and win sprints, I can't see Urán necessarily being in the team unless he's going to be a real lone wolf just doing his own thing.
What about Petacchi? I mean, 39 now, maybe approaching 40. He'd retired, as far as we knew, and now he's back. That's an odd one as well, particularly with the signing of Renshaw.
Yeah, but the key thing about Cavendish's sprint train is having guys that are fast enough in their own right to be able to give Cavendish some kind of springboard that is going to propel him beyond.
And physical and confident, and
yeah.
I think Petacchi knows how to handle himself
exactly,
in a bunch sprint,
exactly.
And I think that's been a big problem as well.
And he's a big guy as well, so he's going to offer a lot of protection. The interesting thing, a bit like a sort of cricket team's batting order, is how are they going to, will Petacchi be last man, will Renshaw be last man, how will they play that balance and get the best out of all of the riders? It'll be interesting in the early part of next season when they're all together to see the kind of experimentation process in the early races.
An odd move for Pataki as well, to go from such a storied career, you know, so many stage wins at the Giro, I've lost count of exactly how many. He lost a few actually, didn't he, due to his drugs ban, but quite an odd move for him at his stage in life to go from being that, you know, team leader for so long to becoming a lead out man.
Yeah, but you know, as you say, approaching 40, he's not doing it for free. He'll presumably be well enough paid to do the training he needs to do, and realistically in the last year or so of his career with I think the LPR team, which he and De Luca are in, he wasn't the same force in the big races. I mean, I think he came to the Tour of Britain and won.
I'd forgotten about LPR. Yeah, he's been at Lamprey the last
came,
couple of years.
That's right, yeah, he went to Lamprey as well, didn't he? And he wasn't exactly the same level. I mean, his level had dropped off, but he could certainly do a job as a lead-out rider.
The other team I wanted to mention, there isn't an awful lot of other transfer news. I spoke briefly to Matt Heyman after the finish today, and he mentioned that he's out of contract at the end of the year with Team Sky. He's been a great sort of workhorse for them, but no Grand Tours for him this year, no Vuelta, no Giro, no Tour. So I'm not sure what his next move will be. But Saxo Tinkoff, that's been a transfer window split. Tinkoff Bank, owned by Oleg Tinkoff, have gone their own ways. Now, throughout the tour, Mr. Tinkoff was tweeting some pretty outrageous things about the team, about Alberto Contador, to such an extent that a lot of people thought it must be a spoof Twitter account. Actually, it wasn't. It turns out it wasn't. And the tweets were an issue in the split that has occurred, which leaves Bjarne Riis looking for a new sponsor, and Tinkoff setting up a mega bucks new team, he claims. But just, I've got one open in front of me. I can't read the whole thing, but on Alberto Contador, he said he's not riding the Vuelta, he is tired, lol. What the hell, Conta is tired from one race? He isn't too tired to receive monthly huge check, though. He's remarkable stuff, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, Tinkoff is he's a very wealthy individual, successful individual, owns a bank, basically.
Yeah,
and I think there's an element, it's a bit like the sort of the oligarchs in football, you know, Roman Abramovich at Chelsea, having, not as publicly as that, certainly, you wonder what Abramovich would be like on Twitter, but people with huge wealth and success in one area of life who perhaps don't really understand sport as well as as perhaps they think. But because they're spending a large sum of money, they think that entitles them to have, to say exactly what they think. And I suppose on one level there's an element to that. But it's extraordinary in terms of, you know, motivating your star athlete to go onto Twitter and make those comments. But, you know, that has led to a fallout between, you know, he's taking his money and he's going to do something else with it. And that's entirely fair enough. You know, sport is almost pure capitalism in a lot of ways. And if
especially cycling,
yeah. And if Tinkoff thinks that his money hasn't been well enough spent or respected enough, I don't know. I don't really know where he's coming from, what's motivated him, other than a huge disappointment that Contador was, you know, to all intents and purposes, really a bit of a flop in the tour.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
Okay, so our final part of our humansinvent.com cycling podcast, we're going to go through a few questions. We've got a few features and things that we're going to launch, competitions and things like that, in future podcasts, but we haven't really had time to think of them yet. That's still very much in the planning stage, isn't it, Lionel? But we're coming around to that.
Well, we only signed our
lucrative
deal on Friday.
Friday,
it's now Sunday.
Sunday. We haven't had long to think about this, but we were going to beef it up. I think there's some very exciting features ahead, and also topics of conversation such as Women's Tour de France, Pat McQuaid, Brian Cookson, all this stuff. Stuart O'Grady, Eric Zabel, doping confessions. Where do they leave us? We've got all that to talk about. We're going to probably leave that till we've got Daniel with us, which we will do soon. But I asked for some questions today from people, and there were quite a few that came through. I'm going to go through them in the order that they came, in fact. Well, here's a question about the Women's Tour de France. Do you think the Women's Tour de France is trying to run before walking, asks Martin TB?
I don't really understand. I mean, Prudhomme, the boss of the Tour de France, has poured a bucket of cold water on the idea of the Women's Tour de France, really.
Bucket of cold sick.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think he disputed the idea of having a Women's Tour de France. But trying to run one in conjunction with the men's race, the sheer size of the men's race, does make it logistically challenging. I personally think that it would be better if something like the Women's Tour Britain, which is happening in 2014, if that were to become the world's best women's stage race, I think that would be fantastic for the sport. It doesn't necessarily need to be the Women's Tour de France, I don't think. I think if the women's...
Not if it's in Britain.
No, but what I mean is I don't necessarily think it has to be the Women's Tour de France.
Yes.
Thank you, Richard.
I think
if there's somewhere else that is willing to and able to put on an event that is going to capture the imagination and get some good TV coverage and attract all of the right competitors, then I think
there's
an opportunity there. And I think the Women's Tour of Britain could be coming along at exactly the right time.
Yeah,
as long as they do attract the all of the top women riders. And I think they will do.
Which shouldn't be too difficult, let's face it, given the calendar they have. I said during the tour that I didn't see any reason why there couldn't be a Women's Tour de France run in conjunction with the men's. But I've changed my position on that, actually, because I think appealing to ASO to run a Women's Tour is hopeless. And when you see politicians like Harriet Harman getting involved, you think this is naive in the extreme, because ASO are not the IOC. They're not an international governing body. They have no remit to equality. Their remit is to make money. And so appealing to them to put on a Women's Tour de France in the name of equality is ridiculous. And I think you're absolutely right that setting up a new event... why does it have to be the Women's Tour de France? It could be anything at all.
I think the size of the Men's Tour de France would just totally dwarf the Women's Tour
yeah,
de France initially, as well. And it would be really hard to get out of
yeah,
the shadow.
One of the arguments I've heard is, all the media are there anyway, but the media are already very busy covering the men's race. Mm. I don't think they would have the capacity to also cover the women's race, and so therefore the women's race would be lost. Next question. We'll try and rattle through these a little bit quicker. Has censored Pat McQuaid got his eyes on an IOC position, hence his desperate attempts to cling to power at the UCI? That's from Colin Hunter.
Well, Pat's already got a position at the IOC. I'm not entirely sure off the top of my head what it is, but I think he's just a...
As you are automatically, if you're... Are you not automatically...
No,
if you're
they made him wait a little while, and
they
got him on.
Yeah.
And, Pat's already on the IOC. It always makes me laugh a little, obviously going back into Pat McQuaid's backstory. When he was an athlete, he competed in South Africa during the apartheid era, when all the sort of Western countries agreed that they wouldn't participate in sport with South Africa. And Pat McQuaid was one of a number of athletes. I think Jean-François Pechot of the Tour de France was another, who went and competed in the Rapport Tour in South Africa under a false name. And for that, Pat McQuaid got banned from the Olympics for life. I've never managed to actually find on the record at the time, in all the contemporaneous reporting, the evidence that suggests that McQuaid was banned from the IOC for life or from the Olympics for life. He was certainly banned from the Montreal Olympics in 76, but he is now a member of the IOC. So presumably that ban, well, it certainly doesn't extend to administrative or official positions.
Clearly not. What was his false name at the reporter? Was it Hein Verbruggen?
No, it was Jim Burns.
Jim Burns, yes. So
Jim Burns for president, hey.
Jim Burns for president. Right, next question. Matthew Tempest. Is it true Iban Mayo really became a truck driver, as Tyler Hamilton's book suggests?
So Iban Mayo
was a perennial kind of rival to Lance Armstrong. Mm-hmm. He was a great Basque climber. No, that's not true, apparently. He runs a property company in Bilbao, and I've been searching him for him recently to do an interview, and he's agreed. So I'm going to go and do that interview soon. I think he's got quite an interesting story, potentially. A question from Geoff Furby. A question, do you think Wiggins will retire if he fails at the Worlds? No.
Definitely not.
He's on a very lucrative contract with Team Sky for next year, and I think he will certainly see that out, and possibly carry on beyond that.
There may be some opportunities for him beyond that that he might not want to turn down.
Yes, I've heard that rumour as well, Lionel. Barry John, for the podcast, should Tour of Britain strive to become the women's Grand Tour? Yes, well, we've just talked about it. 2 to 3 weeks, Barry is suggesting, but I'm not sure that format is appropriate for a women's tour. I'm just not sure that... There's no disrespect to tennis at all, but I'm not sure that there's the strength and depth to justify a three-week tour. I think that would struggle to hold the public interest for that long.
I think I said during the tour that if the Tour de France was invented today, it wouldn't be 3 weeks long. There was just nobody in the world of media or marketing that would say, you know what, a three-week event is a really great idea. The Tour de France only exists, and the other Grand Tours, they only exist in the format that they're in because of the history that they have. I think a women's Tour of Britain could certainly be from Saturday to the following Sunday. Mm. So, 8 or 9 days. And there's certainly, precedent for that with the men's Tour of Britain. So I don't think that... longer is necessarily better.
Yeah, I spoke to Jill Douglas of the BBC about this today, actually, and she sort of agreed with that again, it's about not copying the men's race. It's about creating an event that is appropriate and will work for a women's tour. Tron E, this is Tony Roan, asks, during the Tour de France, why did the journals not interrogate Rhys, Bjarne Rhys and Alejandro Valverde to the extent Froome was subjected to? It's a reasonable question. I guess the main answer is that Valverde was not in the yellow jersey, and Rhys was not running, Rhys's man Contador was not in the yellow jersey, and had they been, I think the subject would have been just as big, but different as well.
Yeah, I think there's a real kind of difficulty getting over to the kind of broader public how those media engagements work on the tour. At the end of each stage, we get to see in the press room, in front of the whole of the assembled media, we get to see the stage winner and the yellow jersey. So Chris Froome was in there every day from basically the second Saturday onwards, and so the impression is far greater. Because he was facing those questions, not daily, but quite frequently those questions came up. Whereas if you're not winning stages or wearing a yellow jersey, you don't step into the media's realm quite so readily, and so the spotlight isn't as intense. Bjarne Rhys, certainly, in years gone by, I remember in 2011 when he turned up to the tour with Alberto Contador, who we all knew was facing the likelihood that he would be banned and stripped of a potential tour victory because of the positive test that he'd recorded after the 2010 tour. Rhys was in the spotlight very strongly, certainly at the start of that race, and that didn't really die down until Contador was out of contention for victory in the 2011 tour. But I think the impression is greater simply because Chris Froome had to face the media for whatever, what was it, 14 or 15 days in a row.
Julian Allen asks, might it create a much needed culture of vocal anti-doping activism in the sport if the Tour de France refused entry to silent or unrepentant dopers, including sports directors? Kind of covered that a little bit. I think there has grown up a culture of vocal anti-doping activism in the peloton. You're thinking of the likes of Marcel Kittel, who won 4 stages this year. Certainly he isn't scared to voice an opinion on it. I think there is that culture, but I do agree that there's still a huge problem in the sport of sports directors with very dubious pasts still being involved. And we're maybe seeing another kind of bloodletting at the moment with the latest the news that the retest on the 98 samples have revealed the likes of Stuart O'Grady, Eric Zabel to have been suspicious, at least, and O'Grady and Zabel have both made fuller admissions now. But the sport's in a real mess because there's such inconsistency between the treatment that's meted out to dopers, whether repentant or unrepentant. And, you know, on the one hand, you've got Eric Zabel being dropped left, right and centre by race organisers and so on, and sponsors. And on the other hand, you've got other sports directors who we know were involved in this in the past, who are unrepentant, and there's nothing forcing them to be repentant. And the move for truth and reconciliation is all very well, but I suppose a lot of people would say, where's the reconciliation?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Silent dopers, presumably silent means those who haven't confessed. And at the moment, particularly seeing the reaction in Australia to Stuart O'Grady and the reaction in Germany to Eric Zabel, who's lost, as you say, a position at the Cyclassics race in Hamburg. He's lost a position at Katusha. You know, he's lost his position on the UCI's Pro Cycling Council. You know, what incentive is there for anyone to face up and say, confess to their role in the sport's past? Jalabert had to quit his position on French television. If you're somebody who might want to join those people and say, do you know what, during my time this is what I did, there is absolutely no incentive to do so, because it will immediately mean losing your position in the sport and any jobs you have. And so there's a real conundrum there for the people who are, and it does boil down to sort of weak management, weak leadership.
Absolutely.
By the UCI.
Even then,
they needed to introduce some kind of, I'm not saying there should necessarily be blanket immunity for people, but on a case by case basis, deal with their current positions in the sport and weigh up whether their confession has been, you know, adequately full. Whether or not there's a sort of genuine repentance and a genuine embrace, willingness to embrace an anti-doping culture.
I mean, even then, you've got massive inconsistencies. Matt White, for example, served a ban imposed upon him by Orica Greenedge, I think, as much as anybody, and he was back at the Tour de France, and you've got his colleague there, Neil Stevens, who was obviously involved in the Festina affair. There are huge inconsistencies. I guess The one scenario where an ex-rider would perhaps gain a sort of widespread respect would be if they volunteered the information with no evidence whatsoever. I guess that was the case with the whistleblowers in the Armstrong case. A lot of those guys did come forward and confess to previous misdemeanors without actually being forced to do so. But we could go on about this all night, Lionel, and night is closing in. Because one of the other things we want to do are our special podcast, looking at one subject in particular, and that's doping, and power data is certainly a big topic that we want to look at properly.
Has this not been special in some way?
It's been special in its own way, but I wouldn't like people to think that, you know, the future podcasts are just going to be me and you sitting on a curb in a square in central London. This isn't untypical. This is not normal.
This is mutant.
This is a mutant podcast that we're doing here. But we'll be joined, as I said, by our third companion in the breakaway, Daniel Freeb, in future. Thanks for listening if you've made it this far. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. Pleasure again.
And we'll speak to you next time.